All right, hold on.
I am holding on.
I'm holding on. Holding on. The one that has cured my broken heart. I'm holding on. Holding on.
Shit, we just did an intro, didn't we?
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Being realistic.
As the story grows.
Hello, welcome back, everybody. This is As the Story Grows. My name is Trav, and on the other side is my cousin and my cohort, Steven. Are you there?
No, I am not.
All right, we're going to wait for Steven. Please wait.
But I am a part of the podcast tonight.
It'd be cool.
Oh, I misunderstood the question. Yeah, I'm here.
You are here.
I am here physically, yep.
Would have been cool to drop some Jeopardy music in there. Ha-ha!
Oh, well. Foreshadowing of what is to come.
A little foreshadow joke. That joke will be funny in a little while, everybody.
And it is.
Hey, thanks for joining us. And this week, how did everybody enjoy Bob Nana? Anybody? Can I get a round of applause? I won't hear it because this is. Yeah. Rad talking to Bob. I got made fun of today that I'm talking to too many emo bands.
Who said that? I was thinking that myself.
And I said,
on a row,
I said, who am I talking to? And he was like, Further Seems Forever. And he's like, Braid and Hey Mercedes. I'm like, that was the same dude. And the guy from Further Seems Forever was in Strong Arm and Shy Halud, too. So shut up.
Who was the person who said it?
It was... His name isn't important, but you know him. And I was in two metal bands with him.
I'll cut it out. Just tell me who it was.
He was in two metal bands with me. And he has really, really long hair. And I don't need to say his name, do I?
Oh, okay. I know who you're talking about. Dracula.
Dracula, exactly.
He's got a point there, though. I was thinking that too. I was like, man, we need to like Steven this up a little bit. It's been a heavy trap side of.
There's some metal. there's some metal coming. There's some punk coming. We got people lined up. We're jockeying people around.
I appreciated all the guests we've had, and I just thought, man, we did go a little heavy on the post rock emo thing, but
I love every single one of them. As a matter of fact, I have something to bring up. This Way to the Egress from Chapter 4, Taylor and Sarah, when they came on, they are on tour and they got their van broken into and someone stole their laptop. They have a... people are just... Ugh. There's a GoFundMe. I'll put the link in show notes. If anybody can throw a buck or two to help them out, I'm sure they would appreciate it. I'll put that in the show notes. But yeah, they're just a typical band rolling around on fumes, trying to get from show to show, and they're actually doing it. And Clarence, their van, they named their van Clarence. Somebody smashed the window and stole a couple backpacks and grabbed a laptop. So
that is terrible.
Bands, if you're about to hit the road, you need to bring an extra person with you who stays in the van all the time, sleeps there, eats there.
Yeah, that's pees smart. Or not advertise that you're in a band. Yeah. You know.
Just lay in the van, and if anybody breaks in that isn't in the band, bite them.
Of all people, you're going to break into this band's van? Like, you know, break into a band's van. That's a tongue twister, man. Break into a band's van that, like, just sucks really bad and doesn't care, doesn't work hard. You're going to go break into Egress's van. Like, those people are actually doing
right,
doing it right in terms of, you know, making business decisions and all that. It's just stupid.
Whose van should we break into, Steven? That's interesting. Let's go down that rabbit hole for a second.
You can break into my broken down van that would have been in a teacher's van.
Your van's really easy to break into. It doesn't move.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So we saw a Colosseum. That was pretty cool.
I did see a Colosseum. It was majestic and it was wonderful.
They, you know, it's funny. They were exactly how I pictured and hoped they would be. I pictured listening to the album, like, how would they actually be live? And I never watched any YouTube footage. And how I pictured them is exactly how they were.
Stoic.
Just like
no nonsense, kind
of loudness. Yeah,
1, 2, 3, 4. Here's 45 minutes. Pummel you. Walk off stage.
Yeah. What kind of, like, you know, like, you know, studio? There's like layers of stuff, and you think, okay, so what would they do as a 3-piece live? They, like, I predicted which guitar parts he would keep in and which ones he wouldn't be playing. You know, like, it was weird. It was like I was watching them, and I was like, this is exactly, even the stage, the way they were on stage, I was like, this is exactly how I pictured them. Him standing there with a little thing next to him that he plays, that little keyboard thing. And, man.
Oh, it's called, the keyboard is called a Mini Brute.
Yeah, that thing is awesome.
It was awesome.
But what's cool though about them is, or, you know, when you picture something like that, like, oh, this band's cool, I wonder what they're like live. What you picture, what you imagine are the things that you want. You know, it's not like you naturally go out of your way to think of something you don't want. Mm-hmm. So when I went to see them live, I was completely floored and completely just overjoyed that I was, like, seeing the Colosseum that I imagined they would be. So
what I liked about them was how Ryan had an ability to really perform, like, really, mm-hmm. like he was taken away by what he was doing up there. And like in the song Used Blood, there's a lot of just four on the floor bass and drums, and the guitar just kind of rings out. And he was actually kind of like holding his hands out in front of him, like he kept saying all this used mm-hmm. blood, all this used blood. He was actually being, like, theatrical about it, not in a cheesy, silly way, but, like, in a really, like,
no, just
I'm presenting this into it as a whole thing. Yeah. And then when he went off on his tangent about how, like, you know, it sucks that we have to be done early because clubs make their money off DJs and not bands, and that's a shame. And it's people yeah. like you that came out to support us and everything that makes it still worthwhile that we trek around and do this. And if you take anything home, and pay attention to this, Christians, if you take anything home tonight, I just want you to take home the love that we have for you. There wasn't any tough guy, you know, I want to see a circle pit, MF-er. Or nothing of that stupid stuff. It was like, yeah. I want this giant, scary-looking dude dressed in all black was like, I just want you to feel how much love we have for you tonight. Thank you so much. Yeah. I love you. And I was like,
well,
wow. I didn't see that coming. You know what I mean? It was really cool.
Yeah, something was clearly bugging him. And I picked up just from what he was saying that it was probably like a lackluster response to their very good, very awesome, best album that's new that yeah. they just put out. And I don't understand. People are dumb.
they're buying the wrong stuff, or, I mean, whatever. I'm with him. I guess I feel his frustration too, because my God, they should be bigger. But, you know, the cool part is that I spoke to him about being on here, and he said, mm-hmm. I don't have time while I'm on tour. I'll talk to you afterwards. So hopefully we get us a little Ryan Patterson. So
he'll be on here one of these days, and when he is, we'll pick his brain about that stuff and see what he says. But I'll tell you what, if you get an opportunity to see them, go see them.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And Childbite, that opened for the band called Childbite, which they're no longer on tour with now. I guess that was just one leg of it and everything, but Childbite was really old, crusty. Singer jumped out and was walking on tables while he was screaming. They were intense. They were very, 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 yeah. very sludgy yeah. and loud.
And yeah, get it. If you get a chance to see either one of those bands, Childbite or Colosseum, check them out. Awesome live show. Please go check out the new Colosseum record and purchase it for, I mean, it's not even expensive. It's like
no
absurdly cheap. You can get it for like 15, $8 or something like that online somewhere.
Yeah.
Go to their, you know, go to their site. I don't even know what this Coliseum
Sound System.
That would be it.
.com. I think. I'll put the link.
We'll post it.
Yeah.
But yeah, great show.
Yeah, man.
So I'm going to ask you a question, okay. And I know today you're going to actually give me a good answer.
Okay.
Did you buy any vinyl lately?
No.
I didn't even realize you pre-ordered this.
I got mine digitally. I didn't order the vinyl.
Oh, okay.
And that, it was given to right. me. Somebody gave me a code for it.
Can you give that to me? Because mine didn't come with a Bandcamp.
What? Yeah, absolutely. I can do that.
And I want to listen to it at work. But anyway,
You ordered the vinyl?
I ordered the vinyl.
You talk then.
Okay. Well, today, as we're recording this, Tuesday, June 16th,
yep.
2015.
Yeah.
We both got the new Ken Mode album, which is
recorded
by... What's that?
Success.
Yep. That's the name of the record. Recorded by one Steve Albini.
Nice.
And they are a noise rock kind of a heavy band. They're very noisy. Their approach to their music is not straight metal, hardcore, or whatever. But their production on a lot of their albums have been that way. So there's just this. It's like listening to spazzy heavy metal, and
with some Melvins in it.
Yeah, a little bit of that for sure. Yeah. With the new record, it's like the noise rock elements are pulled forward, and it's more of a rock production, but it's heavy.
I agree. Heavy, yeah.
It's really heavy, but it's because they're extremely heavy. But the approach sonically is more kind of like, I mean, I hate to compare another Steve Albini production, but it's kind of like what happened with Nirvana. It was like, you know, they got the polished, really big production, and then decided to go get sort of that garagey, dirty, you know, the sounds of like what their amps probably sound like live, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's nuts. The music, what they're doing, the vocals, he's doing something different with his vocals. He's doing a little bit more of like a yell as opposed to a scream kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit more melody in his voice.
Definitely.
It's a different sound from them, but I think it's really awesome.
Almost has like a snarky Jesus Lizard moment.
Oh, it's totally Jesus. That's an amazing example, actually.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Dude, that was you nailed that. I mean, that's essentially what I think this new record sounds like, is a Jesus Lizard type.
It's band. Like if Jesus Lizard and the Melvins played metal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know how when you're making a smoothie, right? Stick with me. Mm-hmm. When you're making a smoothie and it's primarily one color, and then you just add like a fistful of blueberries and it completely changes color.
Dude,
it's mostly the same drink, but you just added this one other element to it and completely changed it without changing it completely. Capish? You know what I mean?
Can we name our next record a fistful of blueberries?
Yeah. I already bought the .com. Fistful of blueberries.com. Be the new one. Nah, I don't know, dude.
Funny.
We saw Coliseum and we bought Ken Mode. So it's actually turned out to be a half decent week.
Absolutely.
But let's get to the business at hand here.
We've got two episodes worth of something special here for you.
Yeah, and I'm not smashing on the podcasts that do double episodes. I understand it's a time content thing and everything, but we don't have any sponsors and we don't really have that many listeners either. So we're not in a position that we really have to care. So we put some long, long episodes up. And this time it was just too much. We have to do two episodes this time.
Yeah. Or
it literally would have been like a 3.5 hour podcast. And I don't want people to not listen to it, you know?
His name is Alan Aguirre. Some people probably know him as Ramald Domkus from Scattered Few. And we got a very unique conversation in with him that was very lengthy. And honestly, our intention was to start and just kind of celebrate Sin Disease coming out on vinyl for the first time. And just kind of have like a glorified Sin Disease episode with Alan, but it turned into something much more and much bigger and better. So we didn't want to cut this thing down. We wanted to keep it all in there because we've learned a lot about Scattered View and the history of the band and all throughout this conversation. And it turns out it's not the history that one might expect. Scattered View was good enough to do big things like Jane's Addictions and all that stuff like that. But as you'll learn by listening to this conversation, Alan had plans, man. He wanted, this was a ministry to him full on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And through trial and error, that's what the band was. And that's what they're known for. So, this week we're going to talk to him sort of about the beginnings. We're going to get to know him a little bit and, you know, he's going to take us through a bit of the, I guess the first half, basically up to Sin Disease and what all went down. Next week we'll pick it up and we'll keep going, but that's, we're gonna split it up, and I think we'll have a better conversation with it. We did not really get into a lot of the Spyglass Blue and Ministries Walking music and stuff, but we touched on some little things here and there, but this is very Scattered Few heavy, and I think if you're a real fan of that band and the work that they did, you're gonna take away a lot from listening to these two episodes.
Scattered Few cranked out some amazing stuff, and it mm-hmm. matters to me. Scattered Few is one of the few bands that are tattooed on my body, and I really dig what they did. So this is in tribute to the fact that 25 years later, somebody at Burnt Toast, somebody decided, you know what, I want this on wax, and we're going to do it. So this is all just a celebration of that. And I hope they sell it out and have to do a second pressing. That would be rad. But yeah, this is here we go. Alan Aguirre, Scattered Few, Sin Disease, Part 1, Take 1.
Enjoy. So how are you doing?
I'm good. Had a great day. Woke up, made the Mrs. Coffee. We moved to Utah 2+
years. It's Mr. Coffee.
Yeah, coffee is love to my wife.
Yeah.
So bringing her coffee in bed is big points here. So, nice. You know, we moved to Utah 2.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And our son... Our middle child, our son, and our youngest daughter, and her husband, and our grandson, they moved here with us. Our oldest is still in Dallas, and she's in Dallas. And plus there was another couple, Ian and Alyssa, keyboard and bass for Ministries Walking, two single guys and a single sister. So there was, you know, like 10 of us that moved here. But anyway, so all that to say, my grandchildren are here.
So, that's awesome.
We have he'll be 5 and she'll be 1 in August. So they're getting up there. Or the little girl Tikva, she's 10 months old now. But anyway, awesome. So he came over. So my daughter is she has a business with an LDS lady here in town. It's a birthing, like doulas, and they do birthing clinics and all that.
Nice.
Yeah, it was intense because on Thursday night she had a class. She taught a class Thursday night, and then 2 in the morning, her partner went into labor, so she had to go over there and deliver that baby, and then had to be down in the canyon because we live up in the mountains. We don't live in the Salt Lake City Valley Metroplex. We're up in the mountains, so then she had to go down the mountain to do these. clinics that she's done all day yesterday and all day today after doing a clinic and then, of course, giving birth to an actual baby.
Wow.
So our grandsons, and then, so, you know, our son-in-law had to go in today. He doesn't always work on the Sabbath, but he had to go in today. And so we got to have we were with our grandson all day long today. So awesome. he came over early, and then, you know, we went out. So we have chickens, so he and my wife went down and checked on the chickens and got the eggs. And
wow.
And we went and did a couple errands, and we went by the river and ran into one of the guides here in town. He was in one of my favorite holes right now, and he's just pulling them out left and right. Talk some fly fishing with a couple people there. Stuff like that, you know. Then we went to another part of the river where he could be in the water. So it was one of those days. And then we came back here and just kind of hung around. And
wow, man.
Very, very nice, relaxing day. If you've seen the pictures, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm really jealous of the fly fishing.
Oh, man. It's really...
it looks amazing.
Depending on where you go, less than 4 miles away to the river.
Oh, man.
So, depending on what section, the closest section is probably about 4 miles. Yeah. And it's a top 10 blue ribbon fishery. People come here to fly fish. When the green drakes hit, the green drakes are probably going to be late because it's been really rainy in April. So they'll probably be about 2 weeks late, the green drake hatch. But when they hit, it doesn't matter what day it is. All the access points, it's like a frickin' convention, dude. There's fly fishermen everywhere. And there's cars with, you know, California, Arizona, Mexico, Nevada, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado. I'm serious. It's like a frickin' convention for like 3 weeks.
That's amazing. I mean, it's annoying for fishermen, local fishermen probably, but...
Well, it is, but we love the green drake hatch because besides the green drake hatch, you're pretty much throwing 18 to 22 size, you know, that's the hook size, the gauge.
That's crazy.
18 to 22, that's pretty small. Very rarely are you going to throw a 16. But when the green drakes are here, you're gonna throw between 8 and 12. So these are like the biggest bugs we throw on this river in the year. And so there's that, plus... the hit of the fish on the green drake is top water, right? So it's a bit of a, you know, golden explosion because of these big golden browns we have.
The nice, brown. Yeah. Do you? I was going to ask, do you release what you catch? Because some of the stuff you pull out of there is huge.
Yeah, on the river I practice catch and release. I've only taken a couple fish from the river home. I caught in the river, we have predominantly golden German brown trout.
Mm-hmm.
Some rainbows will come up. It's tailwater river, so there's a lake above us, north of us, and then there's another lake south of us, and then there's about 12 river miles of river between those two lakes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so because of that, some of the rainbow trout from the south lake, the bottom lake, Deer Creek Reservoir, will come up. And so we have the brown, primarily the brown rainbow, and then we also have the Rocky Mountain whitefish, which is it's really susceptible to disease. So we have really good clean water because we've got a lot of whitefish and we've got some big ones. I've pulled out 3 pounders out of that river. There's a picture of me. There's a picture of me holding one, and it's like the biggest one I've caught, and I'm like pretty. It looks cold because it's freezing rain actually, and I'm wearing like a hoodie and stuff. But
I think I've seen that actually.
Yeah. I took a whitefish out of the river once because my wife wanted to try it because she eats fish. I don't. And I catch it. She cleans it and eats it. You know. and one day, one of my favorite sections is known as Legacy North and Legacy South, and I have a really, one of my favorite holes is Legacy South, and she goes, hey, you know, bring me back a rainbow, and I'm like, yeah, because you're not going to catch a rainbow in the river this far up you know, where that section is. It's pretty far away from that other lake. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, good. It's pretty much the middle of the river. And if I'm gonna bring a fish home like that, it's gonna have to be big, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, she said bring me home a rainbow, and I ended up getting my fly deep and long enough and deep enough in this hole in a churny current, and this massive rainbow took it, man.
That's so awesome.
It was like almost like, you know, hey Peter, grab the first fish and there's going to be money in it and go pay our tax, you know? she's like, I want a rainbow. And I'm like, yeah. Cause I'm not going to catch a rainbow. I'm not even going to see one, let alone catch one.
And there it was.
And there it was, this big old boat. Oh, and I took it home to mama.
How much meat do you get off of one of those that size?
It's good. It'll feed two people.
Nice.
It's, so I exercise and practice catch and release on the river. Now, mm-hmm. when the community says we want fish, I'll go to a lake. And there's there's two lakes. One of them I can actually see from my deck. It's going to be about 6 miles, you know, south of us. And then there's one above mm-hmm. us. But then I'll drive. There's two lakes in the mountains south of us that I'll go and I'll go to the furthest one. It's called Starvation Reservoir. And when we go down there, the daily limit, you can harvest 4 fish a day. We'll go down there and 2 people can harvest their limit in 2 hours.
Wow.
And it's in the lake, so it's traditional spin cast off the bank, and we're tossing power bait. And these things are 2 to 3 pounds. They're huge, and they're fighters. And if you're not holding on to your rod when they strike, they'll rip that rod out of your hand.
Yeah, I bet.
Absolutely. Yeah. And these things are 2 to 3 pounds after gutting them. And my wife, when I first brought them home, and we're off the bank, we're not in a boat. And when I first brought my first starvation, you know, rainbow trout experience, this is 2 years ago, she was, again, I don't eat fish, so she's like, oh my gosh, this is a rainbow trout? And I'm like, yeah, why? She goes, the meat is like red, like salmon, it's not white. And I'm like, it's because they're not farmed. These are wild fish. We have salmon in our lakes, dude. So there's 12 river miles, and they say 3,000 fish per mile.
Shh. Wow, man.
This is why people come here to fish.
It's and crazy. So
because and because people come here to fish, it's a death. Well, we live. Okay, so the Salt Lake City Valley is about 2,000 plus feet below us. Probably a little bit more than that. And so, you know, as far north as like Ogden and as far south as, you know, south of Provo, it's a third of the metroplex of Dallas-Fort Worth.
Okay.
So going to L.A. to Dallas was a massive, you know, step down. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it took a little while for me to get used to that. Going from Dallas, the Dallas metroplex, to here is... We might as well be in Mayberry, but based on the size of the Salt Lake City Valley, Lake Valley, we don't even live down there. We live, we're about 30 minutes up the mountain from Orem and Provo, and we're about an hour or so, 40 minutes up the mountain from Salt Lake City. So we're up in those mountains east of Salt Lake Valley, and so, you know, there's the two biggest cities up here are Park City, which is 8,000. The Park City proper, like A4060, is 8,000. There's probably about 20,000+ in Summit County, which includes, you know, Park City and the surrounding areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then south of us, south of Park City. Is a lake between Park City and Heber Valley is a lake, and then the river starts. So the river runs the whole Heber Valley. Heber Valley has the city of Heber City and Midway, and there's about 11,000 in that valley. So combined, you're talking maybe 30,000-35,000 if you're lucky. I've done festivals bigger than that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That gives you some perspective. You know, we went from, you know, LA to DFW to 20,000 people.
But
this
but
is way a, more it's a destination beautiful. Location.
What?
As I say, but way more beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. This place, well, that's, yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's a destination location. This is where people go to vacation. Park City for all the skiing. It's known for its skiing. The greatest snow on earth is what Utah's known for. Park City is all has all the skiing, all the ski resorts. It's a ski resort town, like Telluride or Aspen. Hmm. And then, of course, the Sundance Film Festival. Heber Valley has all the fly fishing, the golfing. Well, you know, Park City has golfing, but Heber's got some beautiful golf courses. I've got up along the mountain, we've got 90 holes of public golf, and it's just spectacular at the base of the mountain. Nice. It's just gorgeous. Of course, all the ATV, mountain biking, mountain climbing, hiking, every sort of bicycle
this is like
you can think of.
Oh, man.
Plus the lakes.
I'm an outdoorsy guy.
Right, myself. And then all the lake activities, right? So it's almost like they won't even let you into the state if you don't have an RV, a boat, and some sort of ATV. You know, I'm serious. So on a Wednesday or Thursday, it becomes very congested up here with all the RVs and boat. I mean, because this is where people go to vacation. Right. I love it here. You know, we waited 18 years to physically move here.
So that's somewhere you've always wanted to be.
Well, yeah. In 1993 in L.A., my wife had a vision on a Sunday morning of this, like, white structure. And, then you know, and it's surrounded by snow and everything. And the next weekend, she has the same vision of the same structure, but it's like summer or spring.
Mm.
And she's like, she asked the Lord, what is this? And he goes, this is where you will live. Now, there's no cell phones, there's no internet, there's no Instagram, there's no Facebook, there's none of that. And so she described it to me, and we had to figure, so as I traveled touring, I kept my eye out for this place. And 2 years later, we came and visited Park City, and as you're coming in off the 80, Interstate 80, to get into Park City, she screamed, there it is. And I knew exactly what she was talking about. And I looked at her. I didn't even look at what she was looking at.
Wow.
I looked at her and I go, are you sure? She goes, yeah. And I'm like, are you absolutely sure? She's like, yeah. And so our friend, the pastor that married us in L.A., he was here at first, then went back to L.A. He's from L.A. And the pastor there, that's where we met him. Then he came back here when we moved to Dallas. That's who we were visiting. He goes, what's going on? What's going on? And I'm like, pull over. We want to look at this thing. What is this? And he goes, well, what's going on? So we told him the vision that we had in his church 2 years prior to this. And he goes, whoa. I go, what is this? And he goes, well, it's a historical landmark. It represents Park City. Have you not seen that? We blogged about it and everything before we moved here, letting everybody know.
I'm trying to remember. I mean, I definitely saw that you were moving up and you were doing a church or something.
Well, we came to co-pastor this guy's church. The guy that, like, you know, this guy I'm talking about. He was one of.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So this was in 93 was the vision, right? Right.
In 95
later from that,
we found it. We came and visited and saw it, and then. And then, but we were living in Dallas at that time. We had just moved to Dallas a year prior to that, and then we saw this building. And then we went back to Dallas. And then 18 years later, we finally moved here.
Man,
we waited on the Lord in Dallas for 18 years. All right, if you're on if you're on Facebook, I'm sending you the link, and. To our little story, and then there's an image of the actual white structure. It's an old dairy farm that the city bought so that they, you know, so it would never be destroyed. And it's a landmark.
Oh, weird.
It's a landmark.
Oh, okay. I'm seeing what you're saying now about the actual vision, like an actual structure you saw.
Yeah, she had a vision of this structure.
Oh, wow. That's wild.
That's incredible. And then right before, so we're in Dallas. We're waiting 18 years to move here. See, that's a picture of how old the kids were back then. I don't know if you're looking at this.
Okay. I have it pulled down.
So anyway, we're in Dallas. We're doing ministries walking, and my wife's about to leave her amazing job that she loved, in the corporate world in Dallas, and she's in the kitchen in Dallas, and she goes like from one counter to the other, and she's transported into a different kitchen, and she saw every freaking detail of this kitchen, and out the window, and there's snow-capped mountains.
Wow. Out
the sliding glass door on the other side, snow-capped mountains, and she's looking at this kitchen, and then all of a sudden, she's back in Dallas, in her Dallas kitchen, and she goes, "What was that?" And the Lord goes, I'm doing a new thing. We live in the house. We live in the house of with that kitchen.
Oh, okay. That's wild.
Jeez. It's phenomenal.
That is phenomenal.
Intense, man.
Says he'll lead you, right, and guide you with his eyes.
Right.
Yes, he does.
Wow.
We believe that stuff.
That is a dramatic example. Not a lot of people have things that clearly showed to them. You know what I mean? That's amazing.
Yeah, that's unfortunate because living a life, living a supernatural life is supposed to be. Oh, here we go.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's my life. There's no way you can't talk about it. This is my life.
I'm not censoring your conversation.
You don't have to. I'm a big boy.
No, we can talk about this too. I really do want to talk about some of the music you've been. You were in a band called Scattered
Dead. Yeah, we'll definitely get there.
Okay. We will talk about anything you want. I'm just saying, here we are. I'm laughing because you know why I'm laughing. But it's my life. There's no way we can't talk. There's no way it can't come up. This is my life. Doesn't matter.
That's
what
okay,
doing,
man.
Right? Yeah,
but it's supposed to be commonplace. The supernatural is supposed to be commonplace. It's supernatural is just natural. It's the natural. It's just super. You know,
right.
Why wouldn't that be an everyday, regular, common occurrence in our lives? We either serve the King of the Universe, and we have His Spirit in us, right?
See, right.
This is everything's already happened. We should be walking in a predetermined script for our lives. That's why Jesus can go, "All right, guys, go down the corner, make a right, and take it about two blocks, and then make a left. You're going to see a young ass there, and tell the guy the master needs it, has use of it, and he'll give you this animal, this beast, you know, this donkey, and bring it back to me." Well, how the hell did he know all that?
Mm-hmm.
Because he, and then of course the convenient Christian answer is, he's Jesus.
Well, yeah,
Jesus the man. How did Jesus the man know that? Well, because it's already happened. He's living a predetermined life. That's how we're able to do this interview right now, but we're also, all three of us, are seated in heavenly places right now. What's that? See, he shows you your face in the future, and it's up to you to get your ass where your face is. So he showed us our
get your young ass where your face is.
Here's the proof text.
it's a t-shirt quote, not to pollute what you said.
Yeah, here's the proof text.
Ananias,
Paul, Saul, Bin Laden, with decrees to wipe all of you guys out. He's staying in a house in a road named Straight. I encountered him. He's blind. He's drooling. The guy's really screwed up right now. And I've already shown him your face. You have to go and pray for him so that he'll receive his sight again, and he has to see your face. I've already shown him your face in the future. Paul is on his way to Damascus.
Bin Laden thing.
Jesus encounters him.
Yeah.
Now blind in a room on a street called Straight. Jesus then goes to Ananias and says, "Hey, Ananias, you've heard that Saul Bin Laden, right? Because he had papers to wipe him out. You know that Saul's in town." And he's like, "Yeah, we know. We're all kind of little tripped out about this. He's here to kill us." He goes, "Well, I've encountered him. He's blind. He's drooling on himself because he's a little freaked out right now. And he's on a street called Straight. And I've already shown him your face. You need to go and pray for him so that his sight will be restored. And you're the face that he needs to see because I've already shown him your face."
Right.
His face was shown in the future. And now he had to go and make that happen. That's the proof text of what I'm talking about. I'm just not making stuff up.
No,
you were throwing me off with the Bin Laden.
The Bin Laden. When you heard this story, I was like,
But you know what I mean, right, by that, right? Paul's like going to go kill a bunch of Christians.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
He has legal documents. Yeah,
you're just going. Your speed is like my brain is like on half the speed of yours.
When you combine the Bible and news from the past 10 years, and then said, "You know which story I'm talking about?" I was like, "No, now I don't know which one you're talking about."
He's got legal paper from the Sanhedrin to wipe out Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
The guy, he was part of the Sanhedrin. This is why Paul is such an important part of the narrative. You know, unfortunately, Christianity reads Paul as a Roman citizen writing him.
Yeah.
No, he's a third-generation Pharisee from the tribe of Benjamin, sat at the feet of Gamaliel, and I'm the most equipped to reveal God's Torah and God's scriptures to you Gentiles who have absolutely no reference experience to this newfound faith that you've been brought into. That's what he's doing. That's who's writing, because that's what he's doing, right? Because he's the apostle to the Gentiles. These Gentiles are pagans. They're not just non-Jews. They're pagans. Who else is going to be able to unpackage this newfound faith? Ephesians 2 says, you know, you were far away from God's covenants, Torah, and the blood of Jesus is brought and Israel. You were far away from the commonwealth of Israel and God's covenants and precepts, his Torah, his instruction, his commandments. And through Jesus, you've been brought near.
Right.
You know, who's going to unpackage this ancient truth to these people better than Paul? The disciples, they're fishermen. They're tax collectors. They're not scribed or, you know, in the teachings of the Old Testament. Paul is. He's a third generation Pharisee, sat at the feet of Gamaliel. He's a super freaking rabbi. He's super rabbi. He's going to be able to unpackage this and blow it up for them. And he does. Unfortunately, Christianity has lost that understanding. That's not how they view Paul today, and that's not how they read Paul, which is why they don't understand him and they get him all wrong. Anyway.
Mm. Wow.
The supernatural is it's simply the natural. It's just super.
I like that.
No, I hear you.
There's another T-shirt quote.
Hey man, I would be terrified. How else are you supposed to do this thing if he's not going ahead of you and revealing to you where you're supposed to go, what you're supposed to do, what you're supposed to say? If he's not doing that in your life, then you're lost. My sheep hear my voice.
Any thoughts? You open this can, man.
It's a can I greatly enjoy. I mean,
my thoughts are this. Hold on, slow down. Everybody, pump the brakes a second. My thoughts are this. This is fascinating, and I would love to talk about this some other time. But it's 11:30 Eastern Standard Time, and we ain't touched Scattered View yet. So we got a podcast to put on the air. So I mean, this is great. I feel like I'm listening to a sermon podcast, and I don't even want to respond because I'm just listening to it, and it's fascinating stuff. But you know, let's get to the task at hand here. We got a whole list of stuff we want to talk to Alan about. We haven't hit one thing yet. So I just want to let's just get this thing back on the rails and talk about sin disease, because I got to get up and go to church.
That's true. That is
amen.
True.
Amen. I mean, I'm not trying to be rude at all. Let's just, no. You know, something tells me, Alan, you'll just keep going.
Yeah.
And God bless you. That's great. That's cool. I totally respect that. Uh-huh, and everything. Yeah. But let's talk about sin disease. Please. Anyone? Did y'all disconnect me now or what?
No, I'm here. Oh, sorry. What the heck, man? Oh, that's crazy. How did you pull it up so fast? Oh, man.
I'm good.
Cute.
That was amazing.
Oh, my gosh.
Sorry about that. Anyway.
Oh, wow, there's a 10-hour YouTube video of this Jeopardy theme song going over and over.
Think it'll be long enough?
All right, let's do it.
All right.
So I was going to say, it goes without saying that Travis and I are huge fans of Sin Disease. Scatterview, a lot more than just Sin Disease. But,
that was like half my life ago, you know.
I know. And and you've done some good albums since, but
yeah, no one believes that.
But this is the one that's coming out on vinyl, and this is my favorite one.
I only put out stuff I like. You know, I like the album too.
Yeah. So, we'll get to some of the. I know I'm not a interview guy, and I don't want this to feel like an interview, but there's certain things I'd like to hit along the way. But I don't know. I guess just if you could just give us a little bit of a brief history, because I know that the band existed long before the record.
Yeah. Yeah. So, most basically, here's my basic bio. 2 months, and my kids hate this first line, a month shy of my 16th birthday. They hate that. But a month shy of my 16th birthday, I was sent to live with a missionary uncle in Central America. And I was not a Christian. I didn't come from a Christian home. I'm from Los Angeles, blah, 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 playing professionally in a band, this and this and that. I had just Don Bowles from The Germs and 45 Grave was playing bass and singing in my band. We wrote two songs. Wow. He sang on them. We had recorded it, and we were about to release it, and the Lord plucked me out of my reality, and I'm now in a third world country under false pretenses, mind you, with a mission, living at with my uncle and his family in Central America. They are missionaries. Mm-hmm. And so I come back from there. When I finally come back to the U.S., I'm saved and I'm a Christian and blah 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 blah. I have no concept of American Christianity whatsoever in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
I didn't know that the spiritual realm didn't exist. Hmm. I didn't know that, you know, the majority of the doctrines and theologies I was about to be exposed to existed.
Right.
They were all foreign. Well, they're foreign to my faith, and they're foreign to me as a human being as well. I've had a problem with American Christianity since day freaking one. So, I show up and I come back to the States. I come back to L.A. and I'm basically going to go to L.A. and visit friends and family for about 2 weeks, and then I'm heading off to Colorado to a commune in Colorado. So I'm here, my brother and I are kind of goofing around. We write a couple songs, no big deal. One of the elders of the church that he was going to, because you know I started visiting the church that he was going to, mm-hmm. came up to me when he found out that we were doing that and said, hey, well, what would it cost to record those? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I can find out. And so I did, and he offered to pay for it, and I'm like, oh. So we've got these two songs, and he wants to pay for the recording studio. And he explained to me how the church wanted to reach out to the youth culture of Southern California. but they wanted to start a ministry. The church itself wanted to start a ministry to reach out to the youth culture of Southern California, but they had no idea what it was, where it was, who it was.
Right.
You know, nothing. You know, they're just regular WASPs, you know. It's a Protestant, evangelical, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant church. They don't know anything about the world that we live in. They're Christians, for goodness sake. And I'm like, oh. So I found out found a studio in North Hollywood. Here's what it's going to cost. And we went to the studio. We had to borrow all the gear. I had no gear. I gave away like three guitars before I left and came back to the States. I brought my 12-string with me, and when I got to LAX, the case was empty.
So I
have no equipment. Now, mind you, I've only been back 2 weeks or so, mm-hmm. and so within 2 or 3 weeks of being back, I'm in the studio recording on somebody else's dime. And they've asked me if I want to help them spearhead this outreach to youth subculture. And I'm like, and so I picked my former lifestyle, punk rock, and a punk rock band to spearhead it.
Die for me, a lonely man. Show me his love again and again. Can't hide the fact that he loves you. I'm here to tell you what to do.
So we started going down to, you know, Hollywood Boulevard and hanging out with the street punks.
And this is, you guys already recorded. What two songs were you referring to?
God Gave Us Life and You. The first two songs on Out of the Attic.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah. I mean, I had, my brother was, had just turned 17 and I had just turned 19.
This is Omar the Bass Extraordinaire we're talking about.
Omar, okay. Right. So we were both, we had just turned 17 and 19. This guy funds the studio recording. We're doing street outreach, you know, street ministry outreach to this homeless street punks in Los Angeles and Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard. It's the summer of 83. Well, no, it's the spring of 83 because we were in the studio in March because I came back to the States in February.
Yeah.
And
wow. That's fast.
And then within another month or so, then within another week or two of having this two song demo, I'm meeting with Terry Taylor.
How? Yeah, that's how did nuts, you, man.
Yeah, how can you connect that?
When I was in Central America, so anyway, I go to Central America to live with my uncle and his family. I'm not a Christian, and I'm there under false pretenses, mind you. I was told I was going down there to do TV at his church. They were a television type of church. They weren't. But that I was going to do TV. I can do that. Go down there for 3 or 4 months. It'll look good on my resume. And you know, I knew better than to go down there. But it was, again, this is the Lord's heavy hand of destiny. You know. And and I'm down there, and it's all a lie. And again, it was because what was the alternative? I'm going to put this. We're going to release these two songs with Don Bowles in the band. See, all he has to do is go walk it into Rodney Bingenheimer. He's already an icon in the scene with The Germs and 45 Grave, right?
Right. Yeah.
So all he has to do back then, if Rodney Bingenheimer played it, that was it.
Yeah.
It's 1979, and Don Bowles is already in 45 Grave and The Germs. I left the U.S. months before the decline of Western civilization started filming in our home, in our backyard. And so what was the alternative? Well, Don was going to walk this really, really, really good recording of these two songs to, the songs were really good, to mm-hmm. Rodney. And Rodney was going to play them, and then that would be it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, God's like, no. So he sends me to a third world country thousands of miles away where I don't even know the freaking language. So my uncle's exposing me to Christian music. Well, what are you going to possibly play me in 1979, January of 1980? There's nothing to listen to. Nothing exists. So So he's playing me Phil Kagi, mm-hmm. Second Chapter of Vax, Keith Green, Daniel Amos.
Yeah.
Love Song, that's not bad. Way, Paul Clark. You know what I'm saying?
So you want to go back to Egypt.
Well, no, that hadn't even come out yet.
Oh, okay, never mind.
That's true. Yeah.
Eventually, you'll want to
go. For Him Who Has Ears is like the only record.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
But there's Shotgun Angel.
Yeah,
and I heard stuff on Shotgun Angel that went, wait a second, this is a country album, country rock Eagles, right? But there's stuff on that album that hinted to what they would become years later.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I heard it, and I heard it, and I went, "There's something about this band. There's something about this that I like." And then the summer of '81, we came to the States, and Alarma had come out. Alarma and Horrendous Discs.
And that's released, like, right? Because it was the heart of Terry Taylor being like, what?
Right.
became known for it.
Horrendous Disc was in a vault for 3 years.
Oh,
so
man.
Horrendous Disc and Alarm
That's right,
came
yeah,
out
I remember
the
that.
Same exact time.
You're speeding, you're going running everywhere. Can't tell you, and listen, tell you I'll be there. I get to tell you.
It's the summer of 81. I'm in the States. We go to like a Christian bookstore in Phoenix, and we're driving to LA from Guatemala. I've never been to a Christian bookstore. This is freaking like weird.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we walked out of there with Alarma, Horrendous Disc.
Oh, man.
Barnabas, the first Barnabas album.
Oh, wow.
Us Kids, Lifesavers, Us Kids. What else did we walk out of? My cousin. We would be my cousin Eric and I, who's 2 or 3 years younger than I am. Anyway, we got to that. I mean, we're in Guatemala, dude, and we're like ordering records and stuff and cassettes from all over the world. I mean, we bought October New on Island Records when it first came out. We bought Boy in October right after October came out because we were like, we were a zine, fanzine kids, you know, because we're not in the States. We're far away.
Mm-hmm. You
know? So, anyway.
Back when U2 was inspired by Daniel Amos as well.
Right. So it all, see how all this makes sense? Anyway, we had a little Christian punk rock band in 1981 called The Aspects, and nobody knows about that.
Wow.
And
that's awesome.
We did recordings and we did shows in Guatemala.
Oh,
to
wow.
To like youth group kids and it was That
wow.
Trumps everybody. That trumps everybody right there. It's got a few trumps everybody anyway.
You were in a punk band.
Yeah.
You were in a punk band in Guatemala in 1981.
Two American born and bred missionary kids are in a Christian punk rock band in 1981 called The Aspects in Guatemala City, Central America.
Fresh off of non-Christian life.
Mind blown.
I don't think I've ever told them.
Yeah, that's rad, man. That's new for me.
So now I'm all this Daniel Amos stuff, you know, Alarma makes sense. I understand this. And so I'm like, man, if I ever get back to the States, if the Lord ever allows me to go back to the States and allows me to do music again, man, I would love for Terry Taylor to produce me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I said that all the time, right?
Good choice.
Dude, I was turning people onto U2 back in 81, 82, and they thought I was nuts.
Man.
Now, of course, you know. Yeah. But anyway, so I get back to the States. We have this. I have a 2-song demo in my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
I have a reason to do now this thing, right? So I pull out a Daniel Amos album, Street Level Artist Agency in Pasadena, right? Which is right around the, you know, not that far. I make a phone call to that phone number. It's no good. They tell me, here, try this number. So I make a phone call. So I'm doing that, and all of a sudden, I'm calling Ed McTaggart now, wherever he was working at the time.
Okay. And for those who don't know, he's the drummer.
Drummer for Daniel Amos.
Yep.
And so I'm excited because awesome. Wow, this is not only am I getting closer now, but this is Ed McTaggart, Daniel Amos.
Yeah, that's you know, funny.
So because we've got the Alarma Chronicles, right? We got the first one. We got this. This is before Doppelganger.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm
talking to Ed McTaggart. I'm Alan. My name's Alan Domkiss or whatever. No, I don't know if was I going by Ronald by then? I think I probably was. Yeah.
Wow.
Because we had Alan Pellerin on vocals, and we had two Alans. That's not going to work. And so I was going by my old punk rock name. Before Guatemala, my old punk rock name was Alan Rommeld. Rommeld is my Lithuanian stepfather's first name.
Oh,
so
okay.
I have a middle initial of R. No name. It's supposed to be Riley, but my mom thought, well, that's not really – my biological father – was Irish Mexican. His last name should have been Riley, but he was illegitimate. So his mom gave him her last name, Aguirre. So his middle name was Riley instead of his surname because it should have been Riley. So he gives me the same surname. My mom's like, no, that's not a real middle name. That's like a last name. So I only have a middle initial of R with no name to go with it. It's supposed to be Riley. So I used Rommeld. Right.
I've never heard of that before.
This is
so. I'm Alan Rommeld. before Guatemala, and so when I came back, we have two Allens. I don't want two Allens in the band, so I'll just go with Rommeld.
And it is Rommeld, not Rommeld.
Right, it's Rommeld. Okay. Ronald with an M.
Sure. So that's where Rommeld was born, because of the mix-up with
two Allens.
Okay.
Yeah. Alan, that was Steven's passive-aggressive way of making fun of me, because I've been mispronouncing that name until three sentences ago.
Yeah, everybody's gotten it wrong. So, sorry. I tell him, look, you know, I used to send you guys letters from my cousin and I used to send you letters from Guatemala, and he remembered those letters.
Wow, that's
and,
cool.
You know, fan letters, and I'm in the States. I'm fronting I have a punk rock band. We have a 2-song demo. We'd love to get a hold of Terry to produce us. And Ed's like, I'll let him know. And then, well, like 2 or 3 days later, he calls my mom's house.
Terry, my mom's or like,
Jerry. Terry calls me back. Oh, that's my number. And so we're at dinner, and my mom answers the phone. She goes, hold on 1 second. She looks at me, and she goes, Terry Taylor? And Omar almost chokes, because I'm not telling them anything. I'm like, here we go.
This is great. Yeah.
And I answer the phone, and we're like, and it's instant rapport. But that's Terry. But it's instant rapport. Instant rapport. And a couple weeks later, I mean, he's going to be in the Valley. He's producing an album in the Valley. I'll swing by. We'll meet. I'll slip him a copy of the demo. We meet. I'm excited because, you know, this is Terry Taylor.
Yeah, and, sure.
I slip him the demo, and he actually calls back. He goes, this is amazing. This is like,
no that's so cool. Oh,
no one's done this. No one's doing this in Christendom. And I'm like, I know. Because see, by now, because see, things I'm meeting, you know, I met Nobody Special. They were known as Immortal Youth. Pat Taylor was Immortal Youth back then. We did a show or two with him back then. So we met the Undercover guys, and so we met Gene Eugene, Adam Again, White Cross. We would meet all these bands, of course, and no one's doing what we're doing. This is the Crucified. I mean, they don't exist. It's 1983.
Yeah.
And so we go in the studio with Terry Taylor. We track 11 songs in 2 days. And 5 of those were on Out of the Attic, and of course we scared everybody. Nobody would touch it. We did do some secular shows, you know, with the secular local shows, you know, in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They didn't really like. They were uncomfortable having a quote Christian band. A lot of people knew us because we were in the street. We were every Friday and Saturday night. We're on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, yeah.
And so see if you watch American, okay, remember 12 Monkeys, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when she's coming to the realization that Bruce Willis is a time traveler, and she looks in her files at a picture of a man who shows up naked in a World War I bunker or trench, and are you following me? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I remember the movie. I don't remember that.
I haven't seen the movie. I was going to promise to take that one.
Keep going. So there's a historical image. There's a historical photograph that she's got of a mm-hmm. guy. There's a story of a guy showing up in a trench in World War I, speaking French, and then disappears. And there's a photograph of him in the trench. Well, so she's looking, because they find a World War I bullet in Bruce Willis in the mm-hmm. future. So she goes and runs back and looks at the picture, and then she looks at the margin, and there's barely visible Bruce Willis in the picture from World War I.
Oh. Okay. Kind of.
Okay. Well,
the bullet thing jogged my memory. I think.
Right. Remember the American Hardcore? The documentary on from punk rock 1981 to 85, roughly, American Hardcore is called. It's called.
Never.
I don't think
it.
I've seen it.
Never seen it.
I know what it is. It was on Netflix.
If you could look at the mm-hmm. margins in the same way this she does, you would see me in the margins of that entire film. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, okay.
The Bad Brains hanging out with the Black Flag guys, you know, all that.
No,
stuff.
No, I totally. I Circle I One. Recognize that.
And I bring it up because Circle One. There's a segment on John from Circle One in the Wig Factory. So we're in Hollywood, hanging out with the street punks, you know, and you know, just loving on them. And then we find out that some guy started a little Christian thing at an old wig factory in Hollywood, and John from Circle One, the singer, got saved, and he's hanging out there, and they're doing Bible studies. So of course we go and check it out, and this is like 2 weeks. It's 2 weeks old. The Wig Factory, John and the Wig Factory, this Bible study for the punks is like 2 weeks old. We show up. So now we have a now we have a place to distribute food to for these street punks, right? These homeless street punks. So they're squatting in hotels like Hotel Hell. If ask anybody from that's from back then about Hotel Hell, it's, you know, these are it was an abandoned hotel where all these people are squatting. Horrible, horrible, demonic place.
Wow.
So we're in the valley, rustling up foods and toilet paper and toothbrushes and paper, you know, toothpaste, you know what I'm saying? All those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're bringing them to Hollywood. You can't really distribute them on Hollywood Boulevard. But now, because of the wig factory, we can bring boxes of this stuff, and they can distribute it to the punks that are coming in and out of there looking for shelter, looking for relief or a place to sleep or a place to come down from drugs or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, so in American Hardcore, there's a segment about John and the wig factory. And again, so if you could look at the edge, the edge, I would be there barely visible because I've been involved with all that stuff. You know, the whole brains and, you know, hanging out with the Black Flag guy, all that, that whole scene, you know.
Yeah.
Kathy DeGran and all that stuff. So that's how so Scatterfew was actually a street ministry to the Hollywood street punks. And from there, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's only one band that's got any sort of scriptural, positive, spiritual, lyrical content in the scene. And who is that?
Other than you.
The Bad Brains. Before Scatterfew started, there's one band in the scene with a positive, scriptural, lyrical content. The Bad Brains.
Got it.
Right?
Yeah, so, I always wondered about that. Like, I never, I kind of got that vibe from them when I got into them, but...
Well, the Rastas.
Kind of refer, yeah. I
the Rastas. Thought
they were sort of the Rastafarian.
Well, yeah. I'm not saying they're Christians. I said positive.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
A positive spiritual.
Like a non-specific miracle. Positive spiritual.
Right.
Right.
Right. It's scriptural, it's spiritual, and it's positive.
Yeah,
everybody exactly. else Everybody else is doing what lyrically?
Just like tearing down.
Yeah.
It's not positive. It's punk rock. It's all negative.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're Rastafarians. So what if we started a Christian punk rock band, or what if we started a punk rock? Because the words Christian punk rock didn't exist.
Right.
Right. Right.
So we didn't use that term because it didn't exist. What if we started a punk rock band with a positive,
the spiritual message, spiritual, yeah,
lyrical content.
Yeah.
So we're already in the streets, and we're already in Hollywood on the streets with the street punks, right? Well, let's add a band to that equation.
Right.
So we did.
It's cool.
And then we called it Scattered Few.
Wow, man. And this is still, we're talking still 83.
Yeah, we're talking the spring, summer of 83.
Okay.
And we're in the studio with Terry and June recording, those tracks that were on, those studio tracks that were on Out of the Attic. And he tried shopping it, and no one, you know, you got to remember, here's what people don't know. Terry even warned me, he goes, look, these people aren't going to like you because they don't like me. because Harry was one of the first. Harry was one of the first Christian rock bands that tried to be a regular band.
No, I
get it. And they didn't like that.
Yeah.
Right? And so they're like, so by 1983, right before Doppelganger came out, we actually helped pick the album cover.
Yeah. Oh, that's rad!
So,
oh,
really? Yeah, isn't it? Yes. So
it's such an amazing cover. I love it.
Yeah. So by 1983, they've already pissed a lot of people off because they're actually trying to be a real band. If they sound like they sounded like a real band.
Yeah, what happened to this Maranatha country band?
yeah, right. So and that pissed them off because well, what's wrong with what we're doing over here? Our little, you know, Christian ghetto.
Yeah.
Thing. We want to be a real band because there's a real world out there. You know, I mean, you got to remember they were on Larry Norman's album label. They were produced by Larry Norman. That was whole Larry Norman's whole deal. But don't lose that stuff. No, wow. I think that's a shekel from Israel. It's a shekel. But hey, buddy, I'm doing an interview right now. Go see what Kiki's doing. Is Ema here yet?
She is here.
Okay. Aww. Go spend some time with Ema. You haven't seen her all day. Oh, come here. Give me a kiss. If you have to go home.
I love you. Thank you for spending the day with me.
That's cute.
Hey, Julian, say hi.
Hi.
Hi, Julian.
Okay, he can hear you.
Hi, Julian. How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
Good.
Good.
You say good night. Say goodnight.
Goodnight.
Goodnight, Julie. Goodnight.
They said goodnight.
Nice to talk to you.
Bye, buddy. Love you.
That's great.
What was the name? Oh, the guy named Steven and Travis. Close the door, buddy. Thank you, buddy. Love you. Bye. That's my grandson.
Julia. Yeah. That's Julia. Awesome. I finally heard the voice. I've seen the pictures. Now I hear the voice. Yeah,
that's awesome. Don't lose that. That's a shekel from Israel. Like, you're never going to hear that sentence again. That was neat.
I have some coins and a little coin thing here. And he grabs
them. Great.
Saba, is this a nickel? No, it's a shekel from Israel.
Yeah.
That's great.
So you know, we're already in the streets. Let's add a band to the equation. And that was...
Yeah.
So he tried shopping it. No one... Like, oh, they did not. Oh boy, did we upset the cart, right?
Did we upset the cart? Yeah, we've heard those stories 10,000 times that nobody wanted to touch Scattered Few, but like, take us back to spring summer of 1983. What were they saying? Like, oh my God, no, we can't touch this. This is, I don't like. Or I mean, give some specifics as to like. Like, what was it like to be shut down?
It will never get harder than Undercover, musically. Christian rock will never get harder than Undercover. Oh, Undercover will be the hardest it ever gets. So whatever what you guys are doing is insane. It's demonic. It's of the devil. It's not God. And I'm like, well, you know what? These people, Undercover's not reaching these people. These people, Undercover can't reach these people. Do you know how often in Hollywood in the summer of 83, I would have to intercept Christians from passing out a God Rules cassette to these street punks? Because song God Rules or Jesus Girl ain't going to do anything for them.
It's a little too beat you over the head.
It's going to make us look really bad.
Yeah.
Oh, these guys don't have any idea what's going on. You might as well be watching Quincy. Remember the Quincy punk episode? Yeah, what's going on.
L.A. coroner Quincy says punk rock contributed to Teen's death.
Tell me, would that include your music?
My music?
Whoever killed that boy was listening to words that literally cried out to me.
Swaying and clapping and dancing and jumping to the beat.
One, two, three, four!
They were actually being controlled.
Why did a kid act like that?
Maybe the greatest persuader there is, music.
You're not really saying that music can kill, are you?
You're the killer! Your whole sick society!
You're a hypocrite! A hypocrite!
What do you think
of? Rock music is one of the most difficult things a Christian young person must deal with.
And it's making my job harder, and it makes us look really, really, really stupid.
But is that your opinion, or did they harder than Undercover?
Here's my... I'll answer that question with a question. Was Undercover out in the streets of Hollywood at 1 in the morning hanging out with street punks?
I doubt it, but I'm talking like the people who you were shopping Scattered Few to, they responded to you with, Undercover is the ceiling. That's where we're going.
That's what we were told. That was not my opinion. Man. How would I say that? Well, these are my friends.
I heard a story, Alan, that maybe from you or not, I'm not sure. You guys were up against Petra or something? Or it was like a Star Song?
I've heard that. Star Song passed on us because they were going to dump their money into Petra.
That is unbelief.
that's what I remember hearing.
Nothing?
So Kerry can't do anything with this. No one wants it. There's no punk scene. There's no Christian punk rock scene.
Well, right? One of my questions, actually, while we're on the subject, is...
Alan was like, this means war!
You have to remember,
daily I'm being exposed to Christian American Christianity, and it's not settling well with me.
Right.
Yeah.
This is just like icing. This is only sealing the deal for me.
Yeah.
Was there any?
You were on fire.
Was there any reason? And I'll refer this question to any of the Scattered Few albums, but in particular, right now as we're talking about it, was there any reason why you guys didn't try to just go for a mainstream record deal right then and there?
Because remember, this was an outreach to the street punks.
Well, I mean, you couldn't have done an outreach if, like, assuming
no one thought like that.
Okay,
that wasn't any part of our plan. Like, if we're doing a church, we're doing street outreach to disenfranchised, homeless street punks on Hollywood Boulevard. And we're feeding them, and we're befriending them, and loving on them. And now we're going to provide them with music that they can listen to that has a positive, spiritual, godly message, because there is no, you can't give them lifesavers, us kids. You can't give them God rules.
So your reputation, anyone that would have known about what you were doing in Scattered Few in any sense, saw it as an outreach, not necessarily just,
right,
oh, we can put this record out and it'll sell.
Right, you know? Right. Not only were we, were we doing an outreach, we were authentic.
Mm-hmm.
Because we weren't doing the Christian Orange County Christian youth group scene. See, right. See what I'm talking about?
Right.
The only reason why any of that existed, Undercover, Altar Boys, Lifesavers, Lifters, any of that crap, was because it was an Orange County youth group scene.
Mm-hmm.
It had nothing to do with the world. It had nothing to do with reaching the lost.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they were encouraged to bring their lost friends to church and to youth group and to these church concerts.
Sure.
So they could hear a quote relevant gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and we're like, what about the kid that's shooting up in the alley behind Seven Seas?
Yeah, he's not coming to church.
He's not going to go anywhere near that.
Sure.
And your music doesn't even speak to him.
Right.
Who's going to speak to him? Well, I will. I came out of that scene. Mm-hmm. Right. 4 years prior to that, I'm in the band with Don Bowles. What do you think my lifestyle was like then?
Sure.
Wow. It's weird because if you
see what I'm saying?
Yeah. If you look back on it now, like, you know, like fans that come along later, like us, you know, like 90s, look back on this sort of that period. It's hard to see, you know, when you're just holding a bunch of the CDs in your hands and you got the Altar Boys and Undercover and Scattered Few, and you're like, it's hard to see that you guys
weren't a part of that.
Well, not necessarily weren't a part of it, but even more importantly, we're like way more gritty than that. Like, it was, you know, you were deeper in the streets and the, you know what I mean? When we look back on that now, we go, oh, well, they all kind of came up in the same time. You know what I mean? But even in that timeline, you guys were doing something.
Same timeline, different. Same timeline, absolutely completely different worlds, different paradigms, different reasons for existing. You know how many punk rock LA street punk wars we got like mixed into, you know?
Wow,
where you know, cuz you got the LA Death Squad, the lads, right?
Oh wow.
The LA punk scene was an incredibly volatile and dangerous scene with the gangs there, with the LA Death Squad, the Hollywood punk gangs, FFF, Fight for Freedom in North Hollywood, La Mirada punks, Robert Goodwin, Head Noise ran with those boys. The La Mirada punks, they were freaking violent, dude. You got the Skinhead, the Working Class Oi scene, the Suicidal Boys. Those guys were those are gangs. These are all gangs.
Well, how did they take
Nash,
what you guys were doing?
North American Skinheads. Aggression came out of that.
Yeah.
Who else came out of that? Aggression and another band, Neighborhood Threat. You're talking punk gangs. And now if you're a punk and you're in Hollywood, who are you affiliated with? Well, the way you dress is going to determine whether you're from L.A., Hollywood, La Mirada,
right.
Orange County, San Diego, yeah,
such a different
Valley
world, man.
So I had a couple guys. We had a couple of guys. Omar and our singer, Alan, almost got beat to death in Hollywood by the lads because they look like a bunch of posers, because they look like skate punks from the Valley. I didn't get beat up that night because I look like a Hollywood punk.
Wow.
The hair,
it's
the
makeup, whole
clothes.
World.
It's a whole freaking world, dude. Yeah. And then, and you're telling me Jim with a faux hawk is going to have any... Do you see what I'm talking about?
Yeah. How did they take your sound, like, or what you were doing, rather? Like,
I thought it was awesome. They thought it was awesome.
They actually received the Christ message.
But it's not like they were. It was two different worlds. They're playing. First of all, they're ordained ministers from Calvary Chapel. They're playing to these big youth, these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of youth group kids in Orange County. And it wasn't until later that they even tried to do anything in the general market. I was doing Signier by then,
and you were able to go into these gang areas of L.A. with Scattered Few, what you were doing with the Christ message, and they didn't want to beat you down and kill you.
Right. Here's a good example of that. On a Thursday night, some black gangs ended up breaking into one of the squatting hotels and raped some of the punk rock girls. On Friday night, the LA Death Squad, right, the lads, and the Hollywood punks united to go and retaliate. On Saturday night, I'm out there with a buddy of mine, and like four or five girls, and we don't know where's everybody at. Where's everybody at? No one's out. You know, why aren't there any punks out this night? And guess who gets picked? Guess who gets caught in the middle of this? Oh, I do. Boy. Me and my buddy. Out of nowhere, we're surrounded by like a dozen big, massive, stereotypical, you know, muscle-bound, 6+ black guys. And they're pulling on my buddy's Oyhawk. And so I stand up and I'm like, hey, you know, knock it off. They go, you better sit your ass down. I'm like, look, dude, I don't know what's going on, but you got the wrong guys, man. You mess with the punks, you're gonna have problems with the punks. You mess with us, you're gonna have problems with the living God. And I got clocked by two guys at the same time in my face. So I didn't pass out. I shook it off, but now I'm in a circle, and now I'm Pinata Boy, dude. And I found blood on my back from my face. That's how bad it was. So they're beating the living shit out of me.
Well,
and I'm like, all right. That's it. Now the wrath of God has come down. This really happened. This really happened. Now I've got my hands out, right? And I'm like, Shondo, you know, speaking in tongues, rebuking them in the spirit. And they all stopped beating me. And they look at me. Well, they're not looking at me. They're looking behind and above me with an absolute horrified terror. And they all run.
Really? Dude, that's insane, man. Wow.
It's a pity you couldn't that before the blood on your face wound up on your back, but I mean...
Right, so I walk across the street. I forgot the name of the little cafe there, because I get a glass of water, because I'm going to... How many teeth have I lost? You know, have I lost? Jeez. And while I'm doing that, I feel a knife in my back, and I look, and there's three black guys behind me. And they're like, we'll be waiting for you outside. I'm like, wait for me. Wait the fuck outside for me. You know, I'm pissed.
Oh, my word.
So I walk outside. I walk outside, and I'm like, "Look, man, I don't know what the hell's going on tonight, but as you can tell, I just got my ass kicked by a bunch of your buddies behind Seven Seas. I'm going home now. If you want to stab me, you're gonna have to stab me in the back." And half of them were like, "No, no, no, they're not the ones. These are those Christian punks." And the other half's like, "We don't care. They were led by this guy that had a nickname called Mr. T because he had a mohawk." And he's like, "I don't care, man." Da, 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 da. And the other half are like, "No, leave them alone. They're not a part of this."
Mm-hmm.
While they were arguing among themselves about whether they should kill me or not, right? One half's gang saying, "No, these guys aren't them. These are the Christian punks." The other half are going, "We don't care." I just walked away, and I got in the car, went to another side of the boulevard where there were some punks there, and they're like, "What happened?" And I told them, they're like, and so they start freaking mobilizing. And I'm like, because they're like, "You guys aren't a part of this, man. You guys are those guys from the valley. You guys are Christian punks." Because see, why? We feed these people. We bring them food. Sure. They're homeless. We give them cigarettes and food and toothpaste and tooth. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're taking care of them. We're showing them practical Christianity. We're loving them, but we're not posers, and we're not just normal guys, right? Because, see, my buddy Clayton from, he was in YWAM back then. I met him in freaking 1983 on the streets of Hollywood. He's got the cross thing. He runs the Dream Center in Los Angeles now. But anyway, we weren't normal guys being Christians loving on them. We were actual punks loving on punks. That was confusing to them.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Right. So, because we didn't look like your docker wearing mofos, you know, youth group guys or church guys, right?
Right.
So these guys were like, "That's not cool. You guys, you know, you guys take care of us. You're not involved with this. You guys aren't affiliated with this." You know, they knew who we were. And they started mobilizing. And I'm like, "No, don't do this. This isn't what I don't want that. I don't want
really guys." Sort of gang war.
Right. Well, no, it had already. I was in the middle of it. It had already started. But I'm like, "No, you don't. That's not my deal. That's not my style. I don't roll like that. Don't go and retaliate because of what's just happened to me." Wow. To answer your question.
Oh, man. Well, so they had your back because they saw that you guys were genuine and caring.
Yeah, because we had been out there a couple nights a week for like 4, 5, 6 months, and it just grew. The relationships grew.
Wow. Yeah.
Right? The relationships were growing. Plus, in that amount of time, we were able to start bringing foods and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we had a valid street ministry to the punks, the street punks of Hollywood, the Hollywood street punks on Hollywood.
Wow.
Boulevard. We would hang Crocker so, Bank. We hung out at Crocker Bank on Hollywood Boulevard. And then, of course, the club scene, the clubs, the Café de Grand, all the various clubs that we would all go to that we would see them at because we were going to shows. Why? Why would we go to shows? We're Christians. Well, because that's where they are.
Yeah.
Yeah,
now, totally. Were these Orange County bands, Christian bands at these shows? Are you kidding? You can get killed.
But again, looking back from this side of it, going back, you know, that's what it seems to look like, you know, because you can only have, you know, Wikipedia and your sure. CDs, you know what I mean, or your records. So it's, you know, it's hard to separate all that. Right. But it's
they had no idea what to do with us.
Yeah.
Because we weren't happened playing the game, and we didn't fit the mold. See, why did. How does Spyglass Blue hit the scene in a huge way in vinyl and platforms and an alien motif and not get what we deserved? Yet this other guy comes out with makeup and vinyl and platforms and an alien motif 2 years later, guess who he sold it from, and ends up making a gazillion dollars.
I would love to know exactly who you're talking about.
I think I know who you're talking about.
Who are we talking about?
I don't know. I'm afraid to answer.
John.
Gazillion.
John. Sagan?
Skillet.
Oh, no, I had the wrong guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Who taught John how to wear vinyl and makeup and platforms and play the tracks? Spyglass Blue. Because he opened up for us for like
a month. Man, I never, ever would have.
In 97.
No, never.
I never would have said that we guy taught
him,
ever.
We taught him all that. He stole my shtick and sold it to the youth group masses. I've never been a youth group band. See, why didn't Spyglass Blue get signed with like the Blue EP? Because you're too authentic, Alan. We can't sell you into the youth group market because you'll scare them. Everybody knows that John's not that guy off stage. That's what they would tell me.
Man,
he's not that guy off stage. But you're this guy all the time. Well, yeah.
Stole your shtick and then completely did a terrible job of it.
But anyway, my authenticity has hurt me in that market.
Sure.
Sure, yeah.
Because, you know, Jesus was a poser.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry. We're in 97 now. We just skipped so much.
You skipped Simbazy. So,
and Jawbone.
So, damn it, Alan.
Thank you. Good night.
I'm waiting for the mute. I'm waiting for the cue music to come in.
I love who I am.
Steven, I can't wait till you edit this entire thing. We'll be like, we have a 4-part podcast.
Exactly.
I was waiting for it. So, okay. You can let that play, by the way. So you guys are in the
I'm 19 years old, and this band, Scattered Fuse, got an international recognition, and now I'm being branded a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And the church that we were with that were going to fund this lost their minds on me, and I basically spiral, and I was only going to be in LA for 2 weeks and go to Colorado.
Yeah.
My uncle never showed up. He showed up like 2 months later, and it was too late. I was already in over my head doing what I wanted to do, so I never went to Colorado. And mm-hmm. so by the fall of 2013, screwing my new girlfriend and smoking pot again.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, that's not good. That's why I say.
So you kind of went down a.
Scattered Fuse was birthed out of disobedience.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So that jacked me up, and then we did a little.
You said fall of 2013. You mean 83?
Of 83, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
And then so I'm hanging out with her, and 84 is a horrible year, and then we kind of do a little get together thing. You know, had a couple different guitars, and so we did this. We get back together again for a short stint in 85 with Ben Eschbach on guitar. He would go on to become the Sugar Plastic, and my life falls apart. It's just horrible. 1985 was like the worst freaking year of my life. My wife. And that girl ended up getting an annulment less than a year after we got married or after we eloped. It was just bad. Just wasn't good, you know.
So this is your wife now.
Yeah, well, I knew Christina, of course, and you know, then she came to L.A. and they became friends, and it's all disobedience. It's all like I'm no longer using the script.
Right.
That doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, so in 85, I end up getting together with Christina unlawfully. And I'm annulled. I'm not married. My marriage is annulled. But I started hanging out with Christina. But you know, it's not done the right way. Mm-hmm. And we get pregnant. And right. I release the cassette that we made. So that starts floating around. And I'm going to these Christian Night at Knott's Berry Farm, because everyone's going to be there. All the bands are going to be there. Resurrection Band and Daniel Amos, and everybody's going to be at these things in Southern Cal, because we're all from Southern Cal except for like. Res Band, and so right. I get to see my friends, and of course every time I show up or somebody recognizes me, it's like Scatterfew. I'm like, this thing destroyed me. Why would I do that?
Kind of like now, right?
Yeah, and so Christina, I get to go. So now it's 86, and I start a band called Signier. It's a dark wave secular general market band, and it got really pretty big in LA. I mean, we were on K-Rock. We were getting a lot of airplay. We were playing 3-4 times a month. I mean, it was LA Weekly would do stories on us before we would come out, to promote our show. I mean, it was really blowing up. And we're doing the local show, K-Rock local music show. We're on the radio, on real radio, real shows.
It's blowing up. Just at this point, was Omar still part of that stuff?
Yeah, Omar was in Signe, and it was and when I look back, 1986 to 89, 90 was my most prolific writing period of my entire life.
I was witness to the gallery, the strokes of Queen Terrain, framed in scarlet tapestries, awaiting their display. I stood holding on the banister, your hopes of yesterday. While overwhelming shadows burn the portraits, iron gray,
Omar was on bass. My brother Drew, who's like 16 or 17, learns the parts on the keyboards on the way to a show.
Wow.
So right we on. Kept him. So he's like, hey, do you want to do this thing? Yeah. So we got him out of high school so he could be in the band full time. And so he has GED or something. So I've got both brothers in the band. And we found, and so through Drew, I met a guy named Jerry who was on drums, who would go off to be like, he was in a band called Butt Trumpet that made it for a while. This and that. And then through them, of course, we met another 17-year-old kid, a 16, 17-year-old kid named Paul Figueroa. Paul Fig on guitar,
who's
amazing guitarist, but he's got like the big long feathered hair, and so you should see the pictures. It's amazing. And you know, Paul Figueroa would be, you know, the Scatterfew guitarist. He would go off and do Amen. He was nominated for a Grammy last year or something, you know?
Yeah, he wasn't recording.
He's a studio guy now, yeah. Recording, mixing, production, yeah.
I think his
Alice in Chains.
Yeah, that was it right there. Yep.
Wow. Yeah, he's a real guy. Because he goes, look at, I mean, in 95, when we finally shut the door on Scatterfew, he goes, look, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go do this band called Amen. What do I do to become a rock star? And so I told him, you do this, this, and this. And he went and did this, this, and this. And, you know, he's looking at a Grammy a year ago. I know what I'm talking
That's
about.
That's awesome.
So...
Alan, what do we do to have the world's biggest podcast?
Oh, I could tell you that later.
okay, good.
but I do know how to do that.
Good.
You know, I basically help create and form and produce the number one karate podcast back in the mid to late 90s.
Really?
Yeah.
That early? So anyway, wow.
Yeah, no, 2005. Podcasting came out in 2005. Yes.
I was going to say, man, I'm way behind. I didn't realize it was that early. No.
So
you're doing Sydney, yeah.
And it's like, it's a real band. We're doing like real, we're working our asses off. We're hanging out, you know, we're meeting and hanging out with like Love and Rockets and Peter Murphy and the Jane's Addiction guys.
Right. Right.
I meet HR finally, you know. Yeah. It's like, this is like really freaking going to happen. And then it was just time, and then unexpectedly in 89, it was just like, it was just over. For some reason. It's just like, I think I just got really disgruntled with everybody. And I'm like, and then so I took like 3 or 4 months off, and then I had Tiananmen Square happened, and I had a premonition of us playing at the next Cornerstone with Scatterfew, and so I'm like, oh shit. I use the word premonition to help with the American Christian mentality of prophetic visions.
Okay. And,
well, that's what I figured you were referring to.
Well, it is a prophetic vision, for God's sake. You know what I'm saying? So I have this vision of us at Cornerstone the following year, the next year, as Scatterfew, and I'm like, crap, I need to do the Scatterfew thing again. So I called up him. I'm like, look, Drew can play keyboard. We'll put Paul on guitar. You're on bass. We'll do Scatterfew again. We just need a new drummer. And Paul couldn't do it because of a previous engagement with school, which is why he shows up a year and a half later on keyboards, or a year plus later on keyboards, because we had Jamie.
Paul was your keyboardist for a while?
Yeah, at the end of end of 1990, when we did the run with HR, I had Drew and Paul on keyboards, Jamie on guitar.
Weird.
And we had to get Jamie out of there so Paul could fit his rightful role as guitarist.
Yeah.
So in 92, when Paul, Drew, Sam, Omar, and I, that five-piece, we were the most dangerous band in the world.
Flesh for ears and flesh for eyes, deteriorize, a god in disguise, like we didn't get it, wasting away in the tracks of the chameleons with cycle games. And your members of sin will be down on your blade for your death in the end.
Well, that's it for part one. You've heard it all from the man himself. More to come next Sunday when we post the second half of our conversation with Alan McGuire. We're going to be talking extensively about Sin Disease, sort of how that all came together, and what happened after the record came out. You're going to hear a lot more stories. You're going to be hearing a lot about their working with Bad Brains, HR, all that stuff. We hope you've enjoyed this, and be sure to pick up your copy of Sin Disease on vinyl at burnttoastvinyl.com. It's going to be coming out here in a couple weeks. I think it's like mid-July sometime. Still time to get your copy, so head on over there and pick that up. And stay tuned for the second half. Thanks for listening.
And death shall have no dominion. And death shall have no dominion.
Less for ears, less for eyes. Deteriorate the godly disguise.
Twisting on Rex Winston. We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.